Hello from the Delta MUC. My name's Evan Bach. I'm the Vice Chairman of Communications. Thanks for listening in today. We've got a special edition of the Dots on a Map podcast. I've got Brent Allen, our outgoing Scope Compliance Committee Chairman, in the studio with us today, and we're going to talk about the Korean Air JV scope violation. This violation was announced via a chairman's letter and addressed by Captain Graham by an all-pilot memo. Also, in addition to the podcast, we've got talking points that are going to be available, show notes that you can access on the dalscope.org website. That's our scope-focused website. Check it out when you get an opportunity. It's fantastic. Brent, welcome to the studio. And if you could start off, just give us a little bit of a primer why we're here, what we're going to talk about today.
All right, Evan, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be back here in the Delta MEC talking about scope and its effect on Delta pilots' lives. We've received some questions about this particular JV, and people like to pay attention to it because Korean flies a lot of very large airplanes over the Pacific to and from the United States. So it's Korean Air. They fly primarily back and forth to South Korea, but in this particular JV, flying between the U.S. and Japan actually matters as well, and we'll talk about why and what that means to us. So I figure I'd start out by just talking about the history of the relationship between Delta and Korean Air and how we kind of got to the point where we are right now. Back in 2000, Korean was a founding member of our SkyTeam effort along with Aeromexico, Air France, and Delta. You fast forward to 2013. If you'll recall, Delta was kind of left at the altar by Japan Airlines. They chose to form a partnership with American instead of us. So that began the gradual withdrawal of flying out of Narita. So the company came to ALPA in early September 2013 and requested relief from their contractually mandated 316 weekly Narita slots. The MEC granted them a temporary consent to continue code sharing beyond Japan without meeting that 316 weekly slot requirement. And then by the end of the month, we had LOA 1303, which was ratified, and that permanently relieved the company of the requirement, and it really set the stage for the Pacific drawdown out of Japan. So since that LOA, we've seen the Pacific block hours have fallen between 36 and 40,000 block hours a year. So that was really kind of the death rattle of our Japan flying, as it was kind of the legacy Northwest hub out of Narita. And it started a transformation of the company's business model in the Pacific. So fast forward another 4 years. In March of 2017, Delta and Korean Air signed an MOU announcing their intent to implement a joint venture. By November, the U.S. DOT had granted JV approval. And then the following March, now in 2018, South Korean regulators also approved the JV. So with full binational antitrust immunity approved on May 1st, Delta and Korean Air officially began their JV. So that's a significant time.
Sure, sure. So when the JV began on May 1st, was there some kind of – what kind of began at that point? So right. Switch was flipped, so to speak, on May 1st?
Well, we flipped to Section 1 of the contract, and in 1E10 and 1E8, it kind of defines what the company has to do at a minimum when they begin a new JV. So the first kind of chalk line that we snap there is a measurement period for block hours pursuant to Section 1E8. So once the company starts a new joint venture, they can not decrease the block hours of flying between the U.S. and the home country of that carrier. So in this case, the home country is South Korea, or any country where that carrier operates to internationally from U.S. soil. So that is the big qualifier for U.S. and Japan flying, because Korean Air operates Korean Air Flight 1 and Korean Air Flight 2 between Honolulu and Narita. That's a fifth Freedom flight that they've been operating regularly with scheduled service since 2013. Before 2013, they operated it on a charter basis. So because Korean Air flies between U.S. soil and Japan, 1E8 encompasses all U.S.-Japan flying on Delta Metal, and the company is prohibited from dropping our flying to below the previous block hour floor. All right, so we begin measuring for that on the 1st of May, and it's measured on a rolling three-month period. There's another significant event that we have to speak to in terms of framing this overall situation, and that is in Section 1E10, the PWA mandates that before any amended or new profit and loss sharing agreements finalized, the parties will meet for the purposes of negotiating terms applicable to such amended or new profit and loss sharing agreement. And that's significant because the Delta, for whatever reason, chose not to meet with ALPA ahead of time, and they just simply announced, "Hey, we've started the JV." So, and the reason that's significant in this case is there was no secret that they were pursuing this, and what it really represents is a missed opportunity to preemptively come up with a production balance, a growth metric, something that we could agree upon that could have prevented or detected this violation before it happened. So July 1st rolls around, the initial block hour measurement period is completed, and we receive our first data set from the company later in September. I do get questions about how does it take so long to get the information. Why didn't you have the information prior to September? Well, it's not uncommon. So, for example, the July information would typically come to me and the Scope Compliance and Analysis Committee at the end of August. So at the end of 1 month, we get the preceding month's data that we measure for rearward-looking compliance. So that's not that uncommon. However, in this case, it was running a little late, but it was the first time the company had ever had to provide this information to us for Korean Air. So understandable. We put in the request. We received initial data set that displayed only U.S. to Korea flying, which was within compliance. And it was at that point where we pointed out, hey, we need U.S.-Japan numbers as well with respect to this JV. And after some delay, of the folks of the company putting the data together, they did get back to us. So on September 28th, after a couple of queries from from my committee and from the admin, the company reached out and acknowledged the existence of the violation of U.S.-Japan flying pending further analysis. So they hunkered back down with their data. We did the same thing and compared it to public OAG data that we have access to through ALPA National, and we all came to an agreement about the number of block hours that we're short. So on October 12th, we released the chairman's letter, and Captain Graham released a letter as well. And I think Captain Graham's letter is important. It's important for us to take a look at that and understand what it really means as far as the relationship moving forward. First and foremost, it is an honest assessment that there and an acknowledgement that the violation is out there, and that's good. I mean, the first step to solving the problem is recognizing you have a problem, right? So Captain Graham, I believe he was very forthright in his letter about the existence of the violation, and there are a few statements in there that kind of minimize the impact. So in the second paragraph, the statement, I'll quote from the letter, it's, "We inadvertently missed Koreans' one flight between Japan and Honolulu. When this single flight is included, it puts us temporarily below one measure of our baseline flying requirement for the JV." So let's put that in perspective. He's right. They did miss the Korean Air flight between Honolulu and Narita that qualifies all U.S.-Japan flying. So that flight is the fulcrum that brings into focus that entire market segment across the Pacific. And I believe it was an honest mistake on their part because it is a significant number of block hours that were in violation. And we haven't detected in our dealings with the company in any significant amount of malice where they're actively trying to violate the contract. It is a significant oversight is how I would characterize it. So the other part of that statement is it says it puts us temporarily below that one measure. Well, it's only temporary if there's a fix. And right now, I mean, everything's temporary in life, right? But right now, there's this temporary violation is ongoing every day, adding to the deficit of hours in the Pacific, and there's no end in sight. We have access to OAG loaded scheduled data that goes out a year. It gets pretty nebulous beyond 6 months, but there's not a fix right now, and that's why it is imperative that we meet and confer with the company and try to come up with a solution to this problem.
Sure. So this deficit, I think, also, correct me if I'm wrong, but is it also a result of the fact that we don't fly between the U.S. and Japan nearly as frequently as we used to?
Well, right. We talked about the LOA 1303 and how that kind of began the wind down of the Japan flying. What is really more recently significant is that after the beginning of the Delta Korean Air JV in May, we subsequently canceled a number of Pacific routes. So we stopped serving Guam, for example, and there were some other flying that we used to do out of Narita that we halted. And that is what the Section 188 is designed to protect the pilots from, is joining up with a new partner and then canceling the Delta mainline flying. So that the cancellation of those routes are what led to this deficit in hours. So there's a just the facts, please section to the talking points that talks about what are the nuts and bolts of this violation. So we went over this some in the chairman's letter as well, but we'll highlight it here. So for the initial three-month period, we're talking about 1,970 block hours of Pacific flying. So it's a result of the flight cancellations on Delta Metal between the U.S. and Japan. If you divide 1,970 by the number of days in the measurement period, it comes out to roughly 21 block hours a day. And we equate that to about one round-trip daily Pacific wide-body flight. And we also point out that there's no end in sight for this. So this is an ongoing violation that must be addressed. On a high note, we have received indications the company is willing to meet with us and try to figure out a solution to this. So I know that the negotiators have scheduled a session with the company, and they're going to meet with them very soon. By the time we get the pod out, they might have already had an initial meeting. So while we try to come up with a mutually beneficial solution with the company, we'll also be pursuing the grievance process, which is just kind of what we have to do through the RLA and through our pilot working agreement. It is the process afforded us. So we're pursuing kind of a bifurcated path, if you will, pursuing a solution with the company while also going down the grievance process path, which, as you know, Evan, I mean, we've been down this path about five times now in the last year regarding Section 1, if you count up the delivery violation, the Aeromexico violations of 182A and C, and now with this fairly significant block hour violation with respect to Pacific flying. So we're optimistic that the table is set for us and there's motivation on both sides to get something done. And we know that the window is closing, man. You know as well as I do, Evan, things are pretty busy around here getting ready for Section 6. So I would characterize that as a narrow opportunity that we have, and there seems to be some will on both sides of the table to reach an agreement that, like we've talked about in previous pods, something that would grant the company flexibility to move their metal where they need to, as long as they guarantee the Delta pilots an equitable share of the growth. And we've heard equitable growth a lot, haven't we?
We have, and I've got 30 years to fly. And so I'm really paying close attention to this. I think that scope and these issues that we've been talking about are going to be an important part of my future and a lot of Delta pilots.
Absolutely. Well, so. We want this international growth to be equitable. And the good news is we're hearing that rhetoric from the highest levels of our company. Ed talks about it. Delta's future's global, our international equitable growth, and we love to hear that kind of rhetoric. We think now it's just time to go ahead and put pen to paper and agree to something tangible that we can guarantee the Delta pilots equitable share of that growth going forward. And we have an opportunity to do it right now. I'm optimistic that maybe we can get something done.
Great, great. Well, thanks for coming on the pod, Brent. Absolute pleasure chatting about these very important issues. And thanks for all your hard work. I look forward to staying in touch and keeping track of these scope issues as we move forward.
All right. Thanks, Evan. We'll be transitioning dots on a map, the scope side, over to the next team of scope volunteers that will be rolling in. And we'll have more on that in the future and more pods coming out in the meantime. So thanks again, Evan, for hosting.
Anytime. Take care.